Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there. So podcasting with a very, very busy man goes by the name of Dan Beckner. How are you doing today?
I'm good, man. How are you?
I'm good. I'm chilling. So you are working a couple different bands right now.
Yep.
You've had a lifestyle for a long time of being in lots of different bands. This time it's Operators and Wolf Parade.
That's right. Yeah.
First, Operators is your thing right now.
Operators, we're just about to put a record out on April 1st, and we're doing a month long tour of the United States with one show in Canada and some shows in Cuba coming up, and then I'll be transitioning out of that into Wolf Parade pretty much immediately. So yeah.
I've been on top of the tour, but haven't studied enough to know if you're being serious with Cuba. Do you have Cuba shows coming up?
Yeah, we do.
Okay.
They were originally supposed to happen right after the tour ended, but I think we're gonna end up playing Cuba in the summer rather than just go straight from Boston to Havana.
So. Word, because you've done a lot of the international stuff before. Like, I remember with Handsome Furs, you did like a documentary when you were touring Southeast Asia, right?
Yeah, we did. We actually did something for CNN in 2009. The first time we went to China and a pretty big chunk of Southeast Asia, and we had, you know, they gave us cameras and we filmed 40, 50 hours of footage, and they edited it down and they released it. And there was a short-lived Vice CNN partnership too, because we played the launch party for that, which happened here in New York in the Lower East Side. So, but I toured a lot internationally. I played in places people don't generally want to go on tour to or don't think of going. A lot of Eastern European dates, and you know.
Yeah. Yeah. So you know what's up with getting papers, passports in order.
Yeah, pretty much.
You're a pro with that.
I'm trying to be a pro with that. Yeah, it's all about the documents.
You're a Canadian citizen who was just telling me about your family's history in Germany before we started recording.
Yeah,
who tours a lot in America.
Yeah.
What you were telling me earlier just now, getting the band members of Operators together is complicated with that stuff.
It is, because we're a multinational band. I mean, we have two Canadians in the band, myself and the bass player, and then we have two Americans, Sam and Devoika. So for them to come and play shows in Canada, right, for the Americans to come to Canada, this is the process. The venue that you're playing at and the promoter sends a letter, essentially, or a document to the border. You fill out that document remotely online. You show up, and the border says, okay, this person is here, this person is here. Come on in and work in Canada. To play shows for Canadians in America, working the other way, you, as a musician, you have to pay about $1,500 a year for a visa that is processed through the Department of Homeland Security.
Uncle Sam ain't cheap.
It is not cheap. Yeah. So there's
I didn't even know that.
There's no reciprocal arrangement with the American border for like working musicians, which is, it makes it really hard. Like for us, okay, whatever. We're on a record label. I have a history of touring, you know, and you know, we have the capital to be able to pay for those work papers. But for young bands, it's It's brutal. I mean, if you're like in your early 20s and everybody works a day job and you're trying to get your band on the road in America, which you basically have to go to the States. You can't just play in Canada, right? To do that, if you have five people in the band, you're looking at paying, you know, like over $6,000 US just to go on tour. And if you're starting out, your tour is probably not going to gross six G's, you know? So it's prohibitively expensive, I think, for
that's ridiculous. And that's such a shakedown.
Yeah. It's really like it was kind of post 9/11 and then during the Bush era when everybody got it seemed like the border got really, really intense about work visas for musicians specifically. And then after 2008 when the financial collapse happened, it was I'm assuming they were just kind of like, okay, well, any way we can make money
Because it's like, what? Oh, we don't know if the people are safe or not. Oh, they want to pay us a few thousand dollars. Oh, it's fine then.
Yeah.
Like, what?
Well, ostensibly, the idea is, like, you're paying for the privilege of coming into America, and they want to make sure, the border and immigration wants to make sure that you're not doing a job that an American could be doing. So, you know, like, so a Canadian band playing at Bowery Ballroom, for instance, isn't taking a job away from an American band, which is kind of like a ridiculous premise to begin with, because, you know, even if you're a Canadian band coming and playing Bowery, those ticket sales are, you know, whatever, that night they're keeping the lights on at Bowery. There's, you know, you're selling booze because people are in there. It's paying for the wages of the staff for that particular night. You could kind of look at it like that. So, and you know, if I come down and play shows, it's helping the economy on a micro level. You know, unless the show tanks, and then
well, they're just looking out for the New York scene. That's all it is. They just want to support the punk scene in New York.
Yeah, yeah.
Keep the Canadians out.
Yeah, keep the Canadians out. Whereas in Canada, we'll just let anybody in. You want to play music in Canada?
Like, come on.
Fine. Fill out the form. How much does it cost? It costs $0. You know, we're happy to have you. Appreciate you. Yeah.
Actually, the last time I drove into Canada with some friends, we all had to get out of our car and they actually searched it.
Yeah.
That was actually, because they weren't doing that for everybody. But
you guys must have looked sketchy.
Well, see, they asked us what we brought. Mm-hmm. And the lady was like very stern-faced, very serious, like staring us down, looking us in the eye.
Yeah.
And we were just like, oh, you know, just like clothes, luggage, just like anything else. We were like, friendship. And then she was like, that's it. Out of the car, guys.
Yeah, yeah. You don't joke around with those people. They're not like, they're not, yeah. It's a 50-50 chance whether they're going to be able to take a joke or not.
I was on the wrong side of that. I feel like it might even be more like 90-10.
I'll be, you know,
not many jokes flying around at the border.
Yeah, yeah, it's usually a bad call. But honestly, like, I've had more good experiences going into the States with U.S. border control people than I've had good experience going back into Canada and crossing back through and dealing with Canadian customs as a Canadian is always kind of a pain in the ass. When I was living, I lived in California for a few years, and every time I'd come back to Canada, specifically Quebec, and I'd land at the airport. You know, I was living in the States, but I was still a Canadian citizen. So I'd go through the Canadian citizen line. They'd be like, where do you live? And I'd be like, I live in LA. And I think there's like kind of an inferiority complex, like in general in Canada, where I would just start getting grilled. They'd be like, why did you leave? And I'd be like, well, my job. Like, well, you don't like it here anymore? Like, what's wrong with Canada? It's like, there's nothing wrong with Canada. I just live in LA. Like, please, like, don't be, why are you mad? Please don't be mad
at
me.
It's like, oh, in a band? Or what are your lyrics about? Yeah. Are the lyrics about Canada at all?
It's like, I still, you know, I still love you, Canada, right? Like, I'm just, you know, I'm just living somewhere.
You just
else.
Think healthcare should be privatized.
Yeah.
You had to leave.
Exactly. Yeah. No, that's actually why I moved back to Canada from LA. Free healthcare.
Yeah. Well, anyway, let's talk about this stuff you got coming out. Lots of things happening.
Okay.
So you've been rolling out albums with different projects for a while now in your life. How does this one compare? The Operators album. How's things changed?
I think Operators is really like a culmination of work that I started doing in Handsome Furs, like from about 2006. Handsome Furs was like a you know, we put out three records, and it was a very like electronic project. Just a lot of programming and, you know, sort of more beat based than anything I'd done before. And over that time, I got better at, you know, being able to make, you know, sound design beats, put these songs together, use the hardware properly. And but Handsome Furs was a two piece. So when I started Operators, it was really taking that sort of like electronic world and programming, hardware programming, and bolting it onto like live performance stuff, live drums, guitar, and vocals. So I think in a lot of ways, Operators is just a kind of a culmination of stuff that I've songwriting. That stuff that I've learned in Wolf Parade and you know what I was working towards in Handsome Furs before that project imploded.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?" So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mm. Yeah, let's drop in a little bit of Operators music, and we'll talk about the stuff a little bit more. This is Cold Light.
Cool. Boom.
Boom. So yeah, from what I've been reading about Operators online, a lot of the press, they just keep saying that it's mysterious, like a mysterious project. Like, why do you think people keep saying that?
You know, I don't know. I have no idea.
Press gets something, they just run with it.
I think the graphics for or the images we kind of rolled out at the beginning of the band's life were, you know, deliberately vague, and we haven't, you know, the way we debuted the band too was we didn't have any recorded music, we didn't release any recorded music, we played 3 or 4 shows in a row in Toronto, Ontario, and then just started playing live. So people, the only way you could experience the band or see the music was to see it live, and then you know, we started putting stuff out. So maybe that lends itself to the mysterious assessment. I don't know. Also, it's kind of a icy, you know, post-punky sort of band. Maybe people think that's mysterious. The keyboards are spooky. Maybe that's it.
Writers just like adjectives, man. We like to just take one of those words, hopefully not me personally, but writers like to just take words and run with it.
You know, honestly, the word mysterious probably got thrown around in an early press release and then was just copy-pasted to every single sort of article about the band, because that happens a lot. You'll write a bio and then you'll see verbatim stuff from the bio written without quotation marks around it, you know, in the top paragraph in an article on your band.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, I recognize that. And, I mean, in a way, you're controlling your own image. But
yeah,
there is a sort of inherent falseness to that, you know. That's like, yeah, I guess that's just how it works. But
I mean, bios are basically always flattering, so yeah, you control an image and it's going to be a good image.
Well, because you approved the bio, right? Like, I mean, I remember the first time I ever had to write a bio was with Wolf Parade, and we wrote this ridiculous bio, and then Sub Pop edited it. And I didn't know how things worked, right? So they edited the bio, and they're like, okay, great. Yeah, we have your bio. And then press started coming out about the record, and I was like, oh, that's just the words of the bio as the introductory paragraph. And I realized, I was like, oh, you can just tell people what to... You're essentially writing the first part of the article for them. you know, which is, yeah, controlling your image.
What kind of crazy stuff got edited out back then?
Man, I think the first Wolf Parade bio was like 4 pages of just rambling, like, surrealist nonsense, you know? The keyboard player Haji and I were really into Lotremont, who wrote this book called Maldor, which really influenced like Marcel Duchamp and a lot of the surrealists.
Mm-hmm.
So we were just really heavily into riffing on that book. It was like a super nerdy in joke that no one would get, but just riffing on Maldor in the bio and making it as unpalatable as possible.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And that was just...
That got edited.
It was a little bit after the period where the internet became what it was, where it could kind of seek out those falsehoods. Because earlier than that, a lot of bands would just fuck around in their press releases and get away with a lot of stuff.
Yeah, like make insane... Yeah, I guess it's harder to erase your past and like create some kind of crazy-ass backstory that is then taken as like boilerplate, you know?
Yeah.
This actually happened. But I feel like it still happens. I feel like there's still bands where they're like... You know, there's historical information that's like wiped. You know, if there was another band before it.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I'm thinking of one band in particular right now that is very different than the band that the singer had before he started this more popular band.
Mm-hmm.
Like a completely different genre, style, like affectation in the voice.
Hmm.
It was like a failed experiment, you know.
This sounds like you're riddling me.
I'm not riddling anybody. Something to come up with. You know, yeah.
The wheels have been turning in my head as you've been saying that. I mean, for me, the first example that comes to mind was when Lana Del Rey became Lana Del Rey.
Yeah.
She didn't really try to erase it, but like she had this past as Lizzie Grant as a folk singer that was completely different from what her persona was as Lana.
Her label literally did try and erase it. Like they pulled stuff off the internet, and you know, which it's funny because when I first read about that, I was like, you know, I come from a punk rock background. The idea of I just got my start playing hardcore music, and the idea is, you know, you are who you are on stage and off stage. There's no line. But I watched this thing happen with Lana Del Rey, and then one of my bandmates and operators was like, dude, you're completely wrong about this. She can do whatever she wants, you know? Like there's no rules. Like there's an artfulness to creating a persona.
Yeah.
I think it's just when labels interfere and train, you know, as long as this artifice is being directed by the artists themselves and not from outside forces, then it's just as honest as being in a hardcore band or Fugazi or something like that, you know? I think the idea of authenticity is sort of dead at this point. Like the search for the authentic. What is authentic?
Like to the point where there's just like no real reason to even search for it anymore?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's like a lot of things get wrapped in authenticity and sold as authentic that aren't, you know? Like the whole bizarre sort of rise and now maybe fall of like, I don't even know how to describe it, like, fake Civil War, like, rural hokey music.
Yeah, you know? I know what you're thinking.
Do you know
about
what I'm saying?
Yeah, exactly.
Like suspenders and, like, gosh gee whiz, like, fucking, you know, just that. That is, like, authenticity. That is inauthenticity masquerading as something, like, totally authentic. Which, yeah, I think it's just over. Like, the idea of, like, Grimes, for instance. Grimes is super authentic. She's, but it's, like, costumes and a bizarre sort of like visual presence that is, you know, constantly changing.
Yeah.
Which in itself is like hyper artificial, but is, that's Claire. Like that's,
it's what she's into. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's an honest expression of art for her. So.
Yeah. It's like an extension of what you were just saying about being the same person on and off stage.
Yeah.
If you're a very interesting performance-minded person just in life, you'll probably be that way on stage.
Yeah. And then there's the argument that maybe you shouldn't be the same person on and off stage because it's entertainment, you know?
Okay,
That's what you're doing. Like, you're an entertainer.
So
I'm pretty much the same person.
Yeah,
on and off stage, but But that's me.
And what about with different bands? Because, like, do you feel like there's some sort of difference in persona when you're up there as, like, Dan with Wolf Parade versus, like, Dan with Operators or, you know, with Handsome Furs in the past?
I don't think there's as much of a difference between those bands. Like, yeah. I think with Wolf Parade, I get to, I'm pulled back a little bit more because I'm not singing half of the songs. You know, it's Spencer sings half of the songs, I sing half of the songs, and we kind of back each other up vocally.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, for a lot of his songs, I get to just shred on guitar, which I love doing. And that's a different, you know, that's a different facet of my
live persona.
And for Operators, it's a little more amplified than Wolf Parade, you know. Because I'm not tied to the guitar all the time, I can gesticulate with my hands.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
more beat-driven, so, you know.
Yeah, and I'm interested.
I can interact with the audience a little more with Operators, I think, than I can with Wolf Parade. All that interaction has to be, like, super emotional because I'm kind of rooted to, like, my guitar station and my mic. It's more like classic rock band style, whereas Operators is, like, I can do, like, a cabaret singer style thing, you know. I can actually get down there and kind of mess with people in the audience, which I like doing too.
Yeah. Yeah. What is it like, always wondered with you, what is it like sharing a band in the stage with another front person? Is there any kind of like competition that comes in with whose songs are in the set list, or maybe what song is a single, or what you perform when you go on a show or a talk show and can only do one song? Is there any rivalry there?
That's a pretty good question, man. Because, I mean, it's, you remember the Occupy Wall Street protests?
Yeah.
And how, like, one of the reasons they sort of fell apart was because they had this sort of loosely defined political idea of, like, which I think is noble, of grouping together and then making sure that everyone's concerns were handled before they went forward with, like, any sort of policy statement or, like, we're going to do this or make a decision. That's kind of how Wolf Parade works. So it just means everything takes a little bit longer. But if you attack stuff on a case-by-case basis, like television, for instance, who's going to sing the song, you know? You just have to talk about it, and then you figure it out. But it's never really been a huge issue in the band. We just kind of split everything 50-50. And then with stuff like Divine Fits, you know, it was easy. It was totally easy. If there's mutual respect there, then you're gonna present it as equal and sharing the stage.
Yeah.
I think where it falls apart is if you have somebody who's a giant dick about stuff, who's like just gotta like. And luckily, I haven't ever been in a band with anyone who's. I'm in bands with people who have big egos, but not people who are divas about stuff.
Who has the biggest ego?
Who has the biggest ego?
Yeah.
In Wolf Parade
or any of you just bands you've been in.
Jeez, man, that's a good question. You know, honestly, probably this guy Brian Stubbs, who was in the first band I ever played in, which I was a teenager. I was in high school. It was an awful, noisy hardcore band called Say Uncle, and Brian was convinced that he was like a virtuoso drummer.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So he would just solo like every half bar. He could play a beat for like. You know, maybe like 1, 2, 3, 4, and then you get bored and it'd just be like full on drum solo for like twice that length.
And like, yeah, how did that even work for hardcore with just like constant impromptu drum solos?
Yeah, we kind of sounded like ass. I mean, the band was terrible, but yeah, probably Brian. No, luckily I haven't really been in bands with people who have, yeah, ego, definitely ego, but deserved ego and not like divas about anything.
Yeah. Let's play a little bit more. Let's play an old Wolf Parade song, Shine a Light.
Oh, shit. All
right. Why would you say, oh, shit?
Oh, just, you know, we've been rehearsing, and it's funny to, you know, go back to these songs. And
yeah.
You think, you know, there's a lot of little steps to remember, right? Mm-hmm. We're looking at a set. We can play probably 32 songs that we know how to play.
Okay.
And each song has like a million different little parts. And it's kind of amazing that, you know, muscle memory kicks in and you're like, oh, I don't even have to think about this. This is how to play this song. So
yeah, how much have you rehearsed so far?
Well, we spent about a year writing, just getting together every couple of months and writing new stuff and jamming, actually. Mm-hmm. Because we didn't want to start the band back up without doing that. It seemed pointless to like start it up and just rehearse old stuff and then play shows. That
yeah,
it was like sort of counter to our whole whatever philosophy of, you know, making art we all have collectively together. But I guess we've had two solid weeks of rehearsals where we've gone over the old stuff, and it's been fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So its trajectory seems getting a lot tighter.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I think it just took a couple of times of, you know, running over a song, and then everything just kind of snaps back into place.
Yeah. So are you going to be playing new music when you start the reunion shows?
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
It's exciting.
Yeah. We're gonna pepper this set with new stuff.
But just your songs.
No, no. Not both. Everybody's songs. Everybody's songs get their time on the stage.
Do you have any idea of like when you might release some stuff?
No. Yeah. Not yet. If I was gonna guess when new stuff would come out, it's definitely probably gonna be around the around these Bowery shows.
Yeah.
Yeah. That would make the most sense.
And that's soon.
Yeah.
That's May 17th.
That's May 17th. Yeah. Yep.
So that's very soon.
Yeah. I'm pretty excited about it. I'm excited about those shows.
If new stuff was coming out, maybe it would probably be like recorded already, right?
Yeah. Yeah. We've recorded some stuff.
Word.
Yeah.
Yeah. How do you think it compares? Like, do you think, yeah, when people hear it, what do you think they'll think? Like, okay, Wolf Parade, or like, oh.
I think, well, it sounds like Wolf Parade. So that was our main goal, was like, if we're going to write, I don't think that band is capable of writing anything that doesn't sound like Wolf Parade. Like, I don't think we could go into a studio and come up with something that sounded different than, you know, that didn't have like angular guitars or like, you know, something in five over something in four, mm-hmm. you know, and like little tricky parts and stuff. And I just think we're incapable of writing anything that's not Wolf Parade sounding. So I think the new stuff, though, the new stuff is considerably shorter than the songs that we were writing for Expo, mm-hmm. which was our last record.
Yeah.
So they're very compact songs. There's a lot of information in a shorter amount of time. Yeah.
Interesting.
Tight packed songs. Yeah. Really just wanted to write like maximum impact songs that had a bunch of parts and were like digestible, you know.
Album title: Maximum Impact.
Maximum Impact. That sounds like a failed 90s action movie. Maximum Impact.
Yeah, combining what I guess it'd be like Deep Impact and Maximum
Overdrive.
Yeah,
yeah.
I was gonna say Max Payne, but it's a video. Yeah. Well, it was a movie.
Max Impact.
Yeah. And what about choosing to do the way you've rolled out this tour with residencies, mini residencies at first? Like, what made you want to do five or six straight shows at the same venue, like Bowery in New York?
Because I love Bowery Ballroom, and I love playing a venue that size, because you get to actually connect with the people in the audience, mm-hmm. in a way that you... I also love playing Terminal 5, too. But with a Bowery show, you can connect with people on a smaller scale and have more of an effect. You know, there's more of an energy exchange there in a packed Bowery show. You know, it's more intimate. And I felt like, I think the whole band felt like this is something we always had wanted to do as we toured, you know? Like even back in 2010 when we stopped playing shows, we'd always ask our booking agent, hey, can we just do like five Bowery shows or like, you know? And it obviously is completely stupid to do five nights in each city. You end up touring for 4 months, right? When you could just pack people into a bigger venue and do one or two nights. So, you know, these shows, I wanted them to be special. I think everybody wanted them to be special. So we thought, okay, we can finally do this. We can do Five Nights at Bowery.
Yeah.
And have it be a more intimate, you know, intimate thing for the people coming to see the shows. And we put up some shows at Lee's Palace, which is kind of like the Bowery of Canada, in Toronto. And they sold out right away, so we just kept adding more. And then we eventually stopped adding them, because really, we could do this for like a week, probably.
Just like a heat test to see how many shows you can add until one doesn't sell out.
Yeah, exactly. it was kind of like playing a game of chicken with the... And the same thing with London. We have two shows in London, so... I don't know. I'm excited. I'm really excited about it.
Yeah, and it's awesome to hear that you guys... It was such a priority to pair with new music. Because for a lot of artists who do like... 10 years since this album, Reunion, it does not come with new music. It comes as just like nostalgia.
Yeah. Yeah, and we're not... There's no way this would have happened unless we started writing new music that was like incredibly... That was important. That was the main thing. That's why we spent like a year before we touched any of the old songs.
Mm-hmm. We
didn't play a note of anything we'd recorded prior to, you know, us getting together, so... It feels good. It feels like, you know, the band took a break and we're starting up again.
That's basically what happened.
Yeah.
Refresher.
Yeah, totally.
But then at the same time, the start of the Wolf Parade shows is 2 weeks after Operators, so you really have to just sort of like shift mindsets.
Yeah, I'm essentially going to fly from, you know, Boston or Montreal out to British Columbia for rehearsals, and then 2 weeks after that I'll be back in New York playing these residency shows. And I like that. I can do that because mm-hmm. I did it before with Handsome Furs and Wolf Parade. But I like being busy. I like being able to transition between those two things.
Yeah.
And they're very different. Like the projects are different. They're different audiences, and there's a different vibe and a different feeling on stage. So it's good to have like a couple buffer days to just kind of switch and then.
Yeah. What's it been like with the Operator shows so far? Playing a lot of songs that a lot of the crowd just hasn't heard because they haven't been released yet.
They've been shocking. Like, it's funny. Like, I think the way we sequenced the record, because some of these songs we've been playing for, some of the songs that came out on the record, we've been playing live for like maybe 8 months before we recorded them.
Mm-hmm.
The audience reaction to like a lot of those songs kind of dictated where they went on the record, or mm-hmm. like even if they made the record or not. And I'm consistently shocked how stoked people are on listening to a set of music that they've never heard before. You know, we just did a short tour of Ontario to get ready for the US tour.
Mm-hmm.
And the set was almost entirely music that was unreleased, except for maybe Cold Light.
Yeah.
And people went nuts for it. So I feel good about that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But you have to work harder when you do that. You have to really make sure those songs, you can't just kind of coast and be like, people know this song when they hear the bass line. They'll be excited or whatever. You're literally just being like, hey, I made this, like, listen to it. And, you know,
mm-hmm.
and you have to just kind of nail it every time you're up there.
Yeah.
If people aren't familiar with it.
Yeah, the one I like the most is
Control.
Second track on the album, Control, and that one has not been released previously, right?
No. Yeah. I think it only exists in a... There's a live KXP in Iceland. We played Iceland Airwaves, and KXP, who I love, they recorded us doing a set at this Kex hostel in Reykjavik, and there's a version of that song on the internet. Somebody recently sent us a video that they took of their kid listening to that version of the song and just basically losing his fucking mind.
Well, yeah.
Dancing, running around the room.
It's an intense dance. It's like a dance song, but heavy at times.
Yeah. Yeah.
Especially with the sax in there, too.
Oh, man, the sax. Yeah. Yeah, it's a weighty sax.
Yeah, let's play a little bit of this song so people know what we're talking about.
Right.
Yeah, it's interesting with Operators because there's these different instruments, these different tracks we're talking about, and it seems like when you perform live, it's all going on stage.
Yeah. The only thing we can't really replicate live every single time is the saxophone, and that just depends on who's in town and who's willing to play sax on stage with us. So on this upcoming tour, our friend Brad is going to play sax on a couple of shows. Actually, you know, I'm just thinking about this now. I should put an open call out to local sax players and just be like, you want to
Brad some help.
Yeah,
Brad just running, following the band.
Poor Brad.
Across the country.
Yeah. No, but I mean, other than that, yeah, everything is live. All the sequencing is live. All the drum machine stuff is live. The synths are live. The guitars, everything. So it's like, it's kind of like a tightrope. It's kind of like a tightrope walk, you know? Everything has to just kind of fit together perfectly. And this is kind of a feeling like, okay, things could go wrong at any second, which I like. I like that sort of element of danger when we're playing.
Yeah, and I think with fan interaction, that would probably help when fans can see what's going on as opposed to a laptop.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't want to shit on laptops, though, because, and I believe this is true, at a certain point, I think somebody in an audience looking at a giant table of blinking lights and cables, which is essentially what we've got going on in the center of the stage, all the synths, somebody looking at that and then somebody looking at a giant pile of blinking lights and cables that has a laptop next to it, there's really no difference, I think, for the audience.
Mm-hmm.
It's still sort of it's just like unfathomable hardware, you know. So, I mean, the only fix would be to, like, I've always thought it would be great to have like a GoPro attached to the top of the table,
being
projected, so people could see what Devojka is doing live, because it's incredibly complicated and like pretty awesome. I get to see it because I'm looking over at the table, you know.
But. Yeah, I mean, because I'm not really a musician myself, a lot of times I struggle to understand what's going on stage. So what he's doing is queuing up a bunch of samples and pressing different devices so that they all come up at the right times?
No, she's sequencing, you know, like a bass line or drum patterns, muting and unmuting. Mm-hmm. Playing like top line, lead lines, and bass lines live, like filtering the bass. It's essentially like a live DJing, live instrumentation. So there's no samples even. It's all analog synth stuff making all that noise. So and it's this amazing dance of like her and Sam. Sam, the drummer, interacting with each other to build the rhythm section. And they do that every night, and it's pretty rad to watch.
Yeah, because it goes so far beyond just playing one instrument throughout a song. You just have to have a little schedule in your mind of what you're doing at each part and be doing the right thing at that part of the stage at the right time.
Exactly.
To get, oh my God.
Yeah, it's a very, like, you know, I write on all that equipment. That's the stuff that I write the operator songs on. But playing it live is... I don't think I could do it, you know? I'm kind of like, I can deal with singing, I can deal with playing guitar, I can deal with playing a mono synth,
mm-hmm.
and I can do all three of those things at the same time if I really have to. But that kind of thinking, that sort of, you know, modular, like this part, then that part, then this part, and then, you know, 16 bars from now, I got to turn the filter down, and then I'm going to put the clap in for every single song. I don't, you know, that's Devojka's world. That's, and she's good at it. So,
yeah. Different worlds.
Different worlds. Existing as one.
Man, well, that's like the pull quote. That's your life in a nutshell, basically.
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah. I, just kind of drifting between these two or three projects at any given time. But, like, I wouldn't rather do anything else, you know? Like, I used to... I've talked about this in interviews a lot, but I used to work a lot of shit jobs, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, name a shit job. I've probably worked it for a couple of weeks. Like, I cleaned the butcher's department at a grocery store after hours. I worked in a bar. I worked at a pharmaceutical company. I telemarketed. I, like, took a shitty drywall from, like, crumbling apartment buildings. And anytime I feel like, you know, like, oh, I'd like some time off, or I just remember when I was working those jobs, all I wanted was a week to write songs. Or even, like, you know, I'd set the bar really low and just be like, I just want one day to, like, not have to do anything but work on music. So after I started making money with Wolf Parade and didn't have to work jobs like that anymore, I felt like if I'm not filling my time up making music, playing shows, touring, then I'm an asshole, you know? Because I wanted that. I wanted to be able to fill my time up with that. And I know a lot of other people who play music and who want to do that and who can't. So if I'm given that opportunity and I don't take it, then I'm a dick. You know, so
seriously, yeah. Like, come on,
yeah. So
get out of bed, write some songs. Like, you're lucky.
Yeah, I feel like it's my like job. I mean, what I do is worth making a living. You know, I feel like what I do has value.
Mm-hmm.
But I also feel lucky to do it. You know,
do you ever feel like you go too hard and it just gets overwhelming and you have to step back?
Occasionally, but it's mostly with the admin. You know, the boring nuts and bolts side of things, which I'm admittedly pretty terrible at, but there's always, there's usually somebody around in the band or like part of our team, who's better at that stuff than me. Yeah. And so we kind of delegate tasks, you know? Yeah. Yeah. But,
yeah, well, cool. Lots of exciting stuff coming up. That's just about everything I had in mind. Is there anything else you want to touch on?
I think that's it, man. I think we're good.
Cool. Well, thanks so much for coming by.
Thanks for having me.
Boom.
Boom.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.